where the wish for us is to maximize our pleasure, or to human, to have the sweet taste of pleasure as regularly as possible, and to minimize pain, minimize unhappiness. And much of what we intend to do, much of what we do physically in terms of day to day, much of what we do with regard to what we talk about, what we write about, who and what we meet, is actually to make our life as good as we can for ourselves and to get over and end as quickly as possible difficulties and problems. And this becomes our primary activity. And sometimes we wonder, when I take a look at my life, is it just about maximizing comfort, maximizing pleasure, having a good time, and minimizing problems and difficulties? Is it just about that? Sometimes we look around us and say, well, seems to be for millions and millions of people. And it's an odd sort of thing, isn't it? Like the Buddha once commented, he said, nothing can be such a problem to us as our own mind. It's a funny thing. Here we are, human beings, living our life, and there is nothing that gives us so much problem as the state of our own mind. It harasses us, hassles us. We go to bed at night. We say, mind, sleep. I want to sleep. And the mind says, too bad. No chance. And one can't sleep. One wakes up in the morning, sun is rising, for those who get up when the sun is rising, of course. The sun is rising, outwardly, it's a beautiful day, light and colour and blue skies and the birds are whistling and the grass is green and the sky is blue. One remembers the words of that popular U2 song, which was it's a beautiful day. You heard this song. And one wakes up and one feels miserable. Miserable as sin, as we say in English. It can't be much more miserable than that. And so it blocks out the beautiful new day, grass, trees, the flowers, the freshness of life, the wonder, the miracle of being alive, and it's all blocked, it's all completely stopped, because one wakes up with, oh, I've got so much to do today, and what I've got to do today, and my mind is so busy, and I've got no time, and people to see, and people, places to go, and my room, 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 the engine of the mind has started up, and it misses the wonder of life. And we call this state of mind, with all the tension, all the pressure, all the busyness and occupation. And then we tell others who question it, but you're not living in the real world. We think living in the real world is being neurotic. This is becoming the definition of it. Busy, 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 busy. And then coming home at night, feeling miserable, and then turning on the news. I mean, can you imagine turning on the news when one is feeling miserable? I mean, it's hardly inspiring, is it? Listening to Mr. George Bush, on the rare occasions he's articulate, and many others. And so we absorb even more misery. I was looking at an old text of the Buddha earlier today. 2,500 years ago, in northern India, it's regarded in India as one of the great periods of human history of deep philosophical, spiritual, meditative, reflective inquiry. Great period of history, in Indian history. And it's an area between the southernmost place of the Himalayas down to what Indians call the Mother Ganga, the River Ganges. And not only at that time was it a hugely fertile plain, a great deal of social activity, a great deal of commerce, there tremendous proliferation in the nature, so people had a good quality of life and deep philosophical, spiritual dialogues and investigations going on, which were recorded. And the Buddha was asked about this. People said to him, "Why should we practice? Why should life is good? Why look into things? Why look into life? Life is okay." And it seems, a number of people at that time, it was a blessed and rather simple but productive life. And one of his responses, he said, quote unquote, "This world is unstable." And when I was reading that, I thought, my God, he said it's unstable 2,500 years ago. He should be living now. Come to Israel for a few weeks, Mr. Buddha. Experience here. Come and see what's going on in Iraq. Come and see what's going on in so many parts of the world. The uncertainty of it all. But even without all the external uncertainties, life is full of it as well. So if you and I are in a situation of life, we come into this world, there's uncertainty around us in all manner of ways, which you and I do not choose, yet we have to deal with. And there's also uncertainty in our inner life. We don't know how we will wake up tomorrow morning. We can't say, tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up blissed out. This is going to be the start of my new day. Blissed out. We can't say that. No, we don't even have the power of control of being able to say what kind of state of mind we're going to have. You and I, we could say to each other, all right, this evening I'm going to be full of love. Everybody's going to know, they're going to be so grateful. Doesn't mean to say that what we say for our inner life, that's what will come. So there's this instability that goes on in our world, and that kind of insecurity which you and I have to live with day in and day out at many levels. But we also and equally see that with our own inner life. And here we are living in such uncertainties, inwardly and outwardly. And the question is, how do we address this? What does it mean to live in this condition? For some, it's kind of get on with it the best we can. This is how it is. This is how it is. We have to live with it. We live, we die. One of my old teachers in the forest in Thailand would start his talks. He'd say, "Dear brothers and sisters, in birth, aging, pain and death." Whoa. Sometimes we forget what we have in common. We've got these four in common. When we forget that we've got these four in common, we get caught up in labels and identities. Sometimes we look and we say, is it just about trying to struggle through? Some, very, very understandably, will say, this world is too hard. I need some kind of support. And I think one of the functions of religion, for all of its strengths and failures, has been and continues to be a provider of comfort. A provider of comfort. And that sometimes in the deepest distress, where we're going through great pain, I've seen and heard enough over the years where some people have said to me, "Bispa, I always dismissed religion. I always dismissed God. I couldn't believe in all of that." But then, in a time of great crisis, for some people, they find, they didn't even know it was inside of them, they find prayer coming out of them. Didn't believe before. Sometimes it just becomes the resource. Others, I remember coming out of a hospital with a woman whose husband had just died. And it was a cold winter's night in England, and we were standing at the bus stop, and just standing there and just in a kind of process of recovering from the loss, she said, "Christopher," she said, "what's it all about, this living? What's it all about?" And sometimes it takes some event in our life or some interest in our life that kind of shakes us up. What's it all about? And I think the willingness to ask the question, the willingness to say, perhaps whoever we are, I don't have all the answers, I can't explain it all. Once that willingness begins to start to inquire, to ask, to investigate, maybe our life can open up and, in Buddhist language, really wake up. To really wake up. Some of you this evening will be here. A whole variety of intentions and motives, and interests, curiosity, etc. In a few minutes, I'm going to ask you. And sometimes we come into this a situation like this, and we're not sure why we're here. And we're not sure why somebody is telephoning either, and Nathan's going to find out. And recently, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she said to me, "I'm in my mid-30s. She said, "outwardly, my life and my inner life actually is very good. I'm still speaking to my parents." This could be a rare event in some households. I have a good network of close friends. I can go to a party on a Saturday night. I've got my boyfriend who's still talking to me. I got a job, in this case a school teacher. I was lucky enough to be able to start buying my own flat in the city, the European city. I'll get a pension. I'm in good health. I go abroad for a holiday. Men find me attractive, women like me. And she said, "But is that
all. She can wake up in the morning and say it's a beautiful day and mean it. Is that all? And sometimes there's a little curiosity. A little curiosity. Sometimes with religion, and I'm talking Buddhism, Judaism, and all the others, rather unfortunately for some, and I include myself, feel that sometimes the personalities in religion, for some, make us want to run away from it. Sometimes it may not be that. Sometimes it's all the forms that go with it. The beliefs, the patriarchal system, the authority that goes with it, things that we can't relate to. And all of that for some, I include myself, having been a Buddhist monk for 6 years in the East. How long were you a Buddhist nun? 4 years, and Zimmy a Buddhist nun for 4 years. So we've had exposure to the, should we say, fullness of a religion, we might say, without commitment. And in all of that, it often deters people. If one takes Christianity as an example in Britain, 100 years ago, something like 70 or 80% of people in Britain went to church every Sunday. It is now down to 4 to 5%. The average age of church members in Britain is 68. It's dying on its feet. Dying, it's dead on its feet. There is more interest to preserve the buildings than to get people to go to church. What an extraordinary situation it is in. So there's this external world, and sometimes, to use the English, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. What I mean by that, despite personalities, despite structures, forms, authority, patriarchal systems, etc., 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 somewhere, in the deepest sense of things, there's something deep and profound which secular life and very orthodox religion, Buddhism included, often stops us from having access to. Teachings and practices, and I'm not a Buddhist, I was never even a Buddhist when I was a Buddhist monk. So much less now that I'm in the grey-haired club. So there's the external world of it. But perhaps somewhere deeper, beyond the forms, beyond the label, beyond the identity, perhaps there's something which is rather deep and rather profound. And that means you and I getting beyond all the external to touch something deeper. One, and not the only one, but one of the vehicles and means for that is meditation, in which it contributes to us having a little bit more clarity and maybe a bit more perspective about our state of mind. It's no fun in life if we're living selfish, neurotic, negative, nasty, fearful, anxious lives. There's no fun in living like that. And there's no shortage of people around who sadly find oneself living like that. So what process of meditation and exploration and looking into things is one aspect for our deeper welfare. Can we live and not be afraid? can we live without worry? And if I may say, in Israel, worry is an epidemic in this country. 10 years of coming and listening to states of mind, when I think of Israel, the word worry gets attached to Israel. You've made an art form out of it. Worry for oneself, worry for one's family, worry for one's neighbours, worry for one's town, worry for one's country. You're professional worriers in this country. But the worry, thoughts, feelings, interacting, sparking on each other, worrying about what happened, worrying about what is happening, worrying about what will happen there. And so the attention lands on issues which are important, but the response, so much worry. It's no wonder. I can't speak a word of Hebrew. Well, shalom. The only important word to remember, really. But I can listen to the tone of voice. And the sheer number of mobile phones in Israel is breathtaking. I travelled up on the train with Stephen from Tel Aviv. Where do we get off near Klil? What's the name of the station? And the mobile phones in the carriage was breathtaking. I tell you, in one generation from now in this country, babies will be born with their hand to their ear. It'll be a genetically modified baby. They'll be born imagining, waiting for the mobile phone to be slipped into their hand. And one can listen. I don't even need to understand a word of Hebrew. I can tell somebody is worrying when they're on the mobile phone. I don't need to understand the language. I can hear it. And somehow we feed each other. This makes it the epidemic. We keep feeding each other around these things. And it's states of mind, building on states of mind. And the tragedy of it is that we justify it. There's a kind of odd voice inside of us which says, but I've got a reason to worry. Which is another way of saying, I've got a reason to make myself really miserable. How could being miserable help anybody? What good is it to be miserable about anything? Does it help? Does it change? Does it stop? No, of course it doesn't. So in bringing some awareness and the process of exploration and awareness and meditative life, one aspect is to look at problematic states of mind. To be not easy, but as clear as possible as we can. And the other is, what is my problematic state of mind? When it arises, I'm not saying all day and every minute, etc. But what is the problematic state of mind really blocking me from really realizing, from really seeing, from really feeling? Rather like sometimes you and I, we say, oh, there are the clouds going by. And we say, clouds are going by and the clouds are blocking out the sun. Perhaps it's not the best analogy to use in a country which is so hot, but if you're English, you know what I mean. Oh no, there's clouds, it's blocking out the sun. And possibly here you say, oh, clouds are blocking out the sun. Oh, thank God for that. But in England, it's the other way. Different relationship to the sun, you know. It's God that, you know, we worship it, you know. It's come. There was some correspondence in the paper a few years ago for several days, and it was a discussion in the letters column of what that patch of blue was up above our heads, because it hadn't been seen for months. So sometimes we say, there's a cloud, and it feels like the cloud is blocking out something. Could it be that when we are experiencing difficult states of mind, I call it worry, I call it being negative, I call it cynicism, I call it being agitated or caught up in something which I must have, or whatever. Could it be that not only is it a problem and a difficulty for us, but also it's stopping the sun from shining? It's not just the problematic mind state and the wishing to dissolve it, but it also, it's a loss of an extraordinary opportunity for something else to touch us, for something else to shine through the being there. And the deepest aspects of spiritual life, or a genuinely deep religious mind which is free from being caught up in belief systems, but a deep sense of religious being, has access and is touched by something of which we might say words cannot speak. Words cannot speak. In the time and the days that we have here, firstly it's a delight to take time on a Sunday evening to come over, and I wish to express the appreciation to Amitabh for organizing and letting people know through the various resources, that's what we call a Dharma gathering, open retreat is taking place. And in the Buddhist tradition, the word Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, it means essentially teachings, like this evening, teachings and practices which contribute to waking us up and keeping us awake. To live life and feel that one is awake, not sleepwalking through existence and crashing all over the place, so to speak. So the Dharma, teachings and practices, are intended to contribute to waking us up. And the program here with Simi and myself and Jonathan and Stephen Fulda, teaches a number of retreats here and an important organizer, etc. We have each day a number of groups, and we take a topic or a theme to explore. Sometimes some of you might suggest something that you feel would be useful to go into. So in the morning time, put the timetable up for an hour or so, hour and 10, 15 minutes, whatever. There'll be a topic, actually put some topics, so probably tomorrow Simi, Jonathan in the morning, put them up, and we might take a topic. It could be trust, it could be letting go, it could be dealing with worry, it could be the practice of meditation, or whatever. And then anyone is free to come to that small group with that particular teacher, and we just sit together, if it's a lovely day in the shade outside or in the room or wherever it might be, and just look at our experience, look at ways of working with things, look at ways to help understanding or cultivate and develop. And that's the intention with these small groups. We also make ourselves available as well for one-to-one meetings. So sometimes a person says, oh, Christopher, Simi, or Stephen, you want to be going to talk with you, 10, 15 minutes or whatever is required. And then we have find a quiet spot for some one-to-one. So us as teachers wish to be, of course, as available to each and every person over the days as much as possible. We also have each day a number of sitting meditations, and obviously for those of you who are here, we
very much wish to encourage that, and we'll be giving comprehensive meditation instructions with regard to that, and some of the important features of meditation. One of the very important ones is being here and now. It's not enough just to read a great book by Ram Dass called Be Here and Now. It's important to sit and be here and now. Many traditions will say and use the language of I am be here and now. It ain't easy. The mind says, oh yeah, great idea. I think too much of I'm going to the past too much. I'm too much in my memories. Good. Be clear about it. I'm always speculating about the future, my ideas, my plans, my ideas. I'm doing that too much, and I hardly live in the present. Oh, good. Be clear about that. Yeah, you're right. Sit. Be still. Be here and now. We'll see how much the mind cooperates. Sometimes the mind just starts to rebel. It's just not used to being in touch with life. It's used far too much to living in views, opinions, daydreams, fantasies, imagination, speculation, ideas, boredom, dullness, lethargy, etc., etc. And it's quite something to say, let me experience this moment. Let me really be here and now. So a core aspect of teachings and the practices working together is genuinely learning to center ourselves in the present moment, for the simple reason is this is where life is. It's not yesterday. Yesterday is, as they say in Australia, dead as a dodo. Dead as a dodo it is. And it's not in the future. Mostly we use the future, not with any good reason, but it's just that we're finding it so difficult to be in the present moment. We run to the future. It's like a huge big hole where we throw all our stuff, our inner stuff, into it, because we're having a job coping with the present. So one feature of meditation practice is being here and now. Another is using, which we'll talk to you about, some methods and techniques such as mindfulness of breathing, care with the posture, sitting, whether we use the cross-legged, whether we use the chair, whether we use the kneeling posture, it really doesn't matter. Now, sometimes the Buddhists are a rather strange lot, I must say. Sometimes imagine that clarity and wisdom has got a relationship to the shape of our legs. Really, that one's got to sit cross-legged. This is the problem of all these Buddhist images. They've gone on for far, far too long. We need some Buddha images of Westerners sitting in chairs or something. So whether you sit cross-legged, whether you kneel or whether you sit in the chair, small personal choice on these matters. Important thing, little care with the posture so the energy feels alert and present. Establishing ourselves here and now and using such as mindfulness of breathing and other practice to really feel centered and grounded as a human being. So that one feels quite comfortable when you're in one of those traffic jams that start in Tel Aviv and finish in Haifa, where the old agitation starts. And as one of the Dharma teachers in California has on his number plate, he's got on the above the number plate, I'd rather be here and now. I think there are probably a few drivers behind who see the number plate and say, I'd rather not be here and now. But anyway. So sometimes we find ourselves in situations, the thought tells us, I'd rather not be here and now. The actuality is, one is here and now. Whether it's called being sick, whether it's called being in a traffic jam, whether it's called meeting with somebody that one would rather not meet with, etc. So part of our meditation practice is to establish ourselves in the present moment, be comfortable with it, be clear about it, be calm with it, and feel the quality of it. Even when our knees are aching. Even when the person next to us is snoring. Even when there's sounds going on around or whatever. Can we just be centered as a way of being present and being established? So this is all part of the meditation process. We'll talk, of course, more about that. So we have the days here. It is, as we said, an open Dharma program. If you ask me, I'll say, come morning, noon and night. I can't think of a better place in this entire planet to be in than be in a situation of awareness and interest and exploration, etc. So do, if you can, spend as much time as possible here. Not because we're not promoting any religion. I have no interest in that, and especially in Israel. I mean, you've got three religions already, and one would hardly say they're getting on brilliantly together. So the last thing you want is a fourth. So we can do without all of that, and we'll just keep with teachings and practices. And therefore, with the good wisdom that's in the hall here, the good wisdom that's brought to groups, the good interest to learn and to look into things, there, put all of that together with the periods of silence through the meditation, with good nutritious food for us, and a lovely atmosphere. And Nathan and Zoe told me that there are also lovely views to be seen there. And I noticed, if you feel very playful, there's a beautiful kids' playground there. Why should children have a monopoly on playgrounds? So please do use the playground there. I even saw a beautiful hammock there. One can meditate in the hammock as well. Why not? We haven't brought them into the meditation room, the hammocks, yet, but not a bad idea. So, hammock. You know what a hammock is? That net you sleep in, tied to two trees. Hammock. There's rather a professional hammock over there, I notice, when we are. So with the days of meditation, some teaching through the talk, some sharing together, the nature and the environment around us, nutritious diet, small group meetings, etc. All of it has one single purpose: to contribute to happiness of heart, to contribute to insight and understanding, to contribute to keeping us awake and feeling really alive and vibrant with life. What could be better? What could be better? So let's have a quiet minute or two, and then I've talked more than enough, and one or two of you may wish to. if there are any questions at all that you might like to ask, sometimes, of course, just out of the program, anything that I referred to or spoke about this evening, if you would like to say anything at all with regard to interests or any priorities or intentions at this present time, any expectations, whatever, feel free to ask and I'll try to respond. And if the question is too difficult, then I'll avoid answering and I'll probably ask a question back. So anyone who has anything you'd like to ask or say or comment on in any way, please, please feel free to.
I wish to avoid appearing to others as religious.
Go on. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I've been getting a lot from Buddhist teaching. I'm excited and happy about when I found myself think that I'm most slipping into a dogma.
Mm.
Where I feel that I'm using that dogma to replace the freer life that I'd rather have.
Yes.
Until this moment when I began to reflect on it is to do with suffering.
Yes.
And I realised that now I think what I understand by suffering is clinging to pain.
Yes.
Clinging to it.
Yes.
So in a way, just thinking of that as a teaching and as a practice, in a way I've cleared away the problem.
Yes.
But perhaps I still have some lingering doubt that whenever I tell anybody that teaching, then I'm instantly identified as a Buddhist. And I don't want to be. I don't want to wear that as a badge.
No, good for you.
It might be true, and then that truth is more important.
Yes. a good point. In the language and experience, and as you know, the Buddhist world does speak a lot, including myself, about the consequences of holding and clinging and attachment and hanging on to and possessiveness, etc., and the problems it creates for the person, and in fact for all of us. So sometimes we make, say, reference to not clinging to one's suffering or whatever, or not clinging to something. And for those who have had any exposure to the Buddhist tradition, even loosely, typical Buddhist response, etc. What one can't stop that so much, but what would be the difference for you between something valuable, if we cling onto and end up making more difficulty for ourselves, it's a practical thing. What would be the difference for you between a teaching which is helpful and beneficial and dogma? How would you know whether it was one or the other?
I think dogma is when I've stopped feeling, and the quality of my thoughts has lost feeling.
Yes.
then it's ideology, dogma.
Alright, a good point. So when, as you say, we lose, sometimes we lose touch with the feeling, we've just got the memory, say, of what we have heard before or what we have read, we've believed it and lost contact with the feeling, and then we're just repeating it, and in the repetition of it, it becomes a dogma, and then it sets up the belief system. I quite agree with you, the belief system, shall we say, inside of ourselves. So sometimes it takes a care with ourselves in religion, as with anything else, how much of it is just repetition. It's been said before, it may or may not have meant something to me, and now I'm just saying it again and just repeating it. Yeah. And to really, really notice, in the moment that we communicate, as you point out, is there some feeling there? Is it helpful and meaningful in the moment? But of course, it may not stop somebody else from still saying, "Oh, you sound like a Buddhist." Can't stop that. Can't stop. If you just heard that, would it bring a reaction?
Right now, I would be afraid.
Of? What's the fear?
I want a freer life.
Right.
That implies, I mean, the, all the reasons, I may not have told you anything, but the ist, the investigation, I mean, it's crazy because it's Buddhism that in Buddhism at the moment I'm finding the most active questioning of life.
That's
that I can remember experiencing at the same time, and it's in the name of that questioning that I resist Buddhism, as it were.
I do feel like empathy with you here. I do think it's very, very important that any teaching and any word is held very, very lightly. So, person may say Buddhism, or may say Buddhist, or Buddhist tradition. There, it must point to this freedom that you're speaking about. If we identify with it, hold on to it, instead of pointing to it, it blocks it. One becomes a Buddhist. One becomes identified with Buddhism. And nothing's worth identifying with. Nothing, 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 nothing. There. So as long as you remember what you just said, it's just a support. It's just a contribution to revealing and exposing and keeping connection with freedom. If it blocks it, throw it out. The whole baggage. Freedom is the vital element, and the questioning and investigation into life pays respect to the freedom. And if the Buddhist tradition and Buddhist practices are helpful, wonderful. And if they cease to be helpful, that's the relationship. Yes, anyone? Anyone been in the Dharma scene before? The Dharma scene, I call it, whatever. Meditation retreats, courses, practices. Anyone?
Yes.
Yeah? So would you like to say a little? What? Anyone? What, where, when?
A few years ago I went to Goenka's Vipassana.
Oh, did you? Here in Israel?
Yeah.
In England. In the nest. 10 days, 10 day session. I know, many years ago, mid-70s, I did two or three. Having been in the monastery for 3 or 4 years before, it felt like Club Med. But Med standing for meditation, of course. But others tell me it's rather intense. Everything's relative to something else. So how long ago was it that you did your 10-day Goenka course?
About 3 years ago.
3 years. Anybody else done Goenka course? Three or four of you around. Oh, that's good. So what were the benefits?
For me, it, just the main point I can point is gave me a good tool to deal with pain.
A good tool to deal with pain. Yeah, it's a five-star tool for dealing with pain. One learns a little bit about body sensations on those Goenka courses to deal with pain. Good. So you're talking mostly the physical pain?
Both.
And both. Mental pain? Yeah, it's a great asset. Any other?
Yeah, but I haven't been practicing.
Since?
Well, here and there, very little.
All right. So sometimes we put ourselves into a situation of rather intensive, people would describe, in 10-day course. There, for those of you who are not familiar, the 10-day courses which take place in different parts of the world emphasize a lot of sitting meditation, 1 hour periods, and a lot of sitting for a number of hours every day, basically. concentration on the tip of the nose the first 4 days, and then what's called sweeping, moving the attention through the body sensations. There. So it faded away afterwards, did it, the form?
I just didn't, it didn't fit in my daily life.
No.
I do yoga, but...
Nice. Mm-hmm.
I would like to hear what you have to say about laughter and humor.
But I'd say about laughter and humor. Some people tell me they only come to listen to Christopher for the laughter and humour.
I heard about this about you.
Have you? Oh God, the reputation. Is that right? All right. What do I think about it? As you see, I'm a bit slow to respond because I can't remember thinking about it, but
well,
I think the Dharma life is the happiest life one could possibly live. So the humour and the laughter is the natural outcome of what's felt inside. So this way, I like humour and laughter. And I remember when I was a young boy, about 10 or 11 years of age, it sticks in my mind, and the teacher in the class called up each child one at a time with one of these most hopeless of questions, and it was, what do you want to be when you grow up? As a 10-year-old, you have the idea. Anyway, what do you want to be when you grow up? So he came and asked me, so it was my turn. And he said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a comedian. So
he started laughing, and then the children in the class started laughing, and I said, you see, I'm going to be a good comedian. So my friends regard me as a Dharma comedian. Anyway, you're going to say. What triggered the question about the laughter and the humour?
In the last few years I'm very interested about finding the point that makes people laugh. I find it a very healing thing to do.
I know the perfect person. What's her name?
Aruba.
She's a good friend. She is the queen of laughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you have not met this person, you have really missed something.
She gives laughing workshops now.
I know. I was here, when was it? Last year. And I gave a talk, and I'd said 2 or 3 minutes, I didn't even know what I'd said, it wasn't. And the roll of the laughter came through. And coincidentally, the princess of laughter, she's the queen, but the princess of laughter was sitting beside her, coincidentally. She started. So they went from one to the other. It was all recorded. This talk has become a legend in 9 months. Because it went on and on and on, and laughing and laughing, and then we go quiet, and then one or the other of them, either the princess would start up, and then went another roll. It was wonderful medicine. It cured many body pains much quicker than Vipassana. So my philosophy of life is have fun and change the world. That's my philosophy of life. Yes, anyone please. Yes, sir.
You talked about meditations.
Yes.
And there are lots of kinds of meditations. Osho's meditations and transcendental meditations.
Many.
And everyone invents a meditation.
So,
you have your own definition of meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're quite right with. As with many other aspects of life, there's a tremendous diversity of meditations. Generally speaking, the Buddhist tradition, has put the areas of meditation primarily into two major categories. One is called shamatha. That means meditations that genuinely contribute to calmness, relaxation, serenity, inner peace, and sometimes to a sense of devotion. So as an example, with mantra meditation, one can say engage in transcendental meditation, and the meditation would be very, very helpful for a person for calmness and relaxation. But one can engage in mantra meditation, such as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, which is a mantra to generate and cultivate devotion to God. A mantra used in two different ways. Similarly, with many other kinds of meditation, there's the more dynamic forms of meditation that Osho used to give as a start, as a preliminary. Known many
sannyasins over the years, a couple of meetings with Bhagwan years ago, etc., etc. And then there are other forms of meditation which include calmness, serenity, peace, inner peace, reduction of stress, all of that is important, but also has a very explicit purpose of contributing to insight, that contributes to realization and discovery. Vipassana, meaning insight, is one kind, really working towards bringing insight. Zen is a vipassana meditation. It's a meditation for real insight, to seeing through some of the contradictions and the dualisms of life. Dzogchen in the Tibetan tradition is a meditation to wake us up for insight and for realization. So some meditations, great value, terrifically helpful, primarily focusing on devotion, focusing on calmness, focusing on heartfulness, such as loving kindness meditations. And there are other meditations which contribute to deepening of awareness, the depth of inner experience, for deep insight into things. And for some that will mean some exploration, perhaps some experiment, to see what is really worthwhile and really helpful for oneself. And then, very simple, that's how they say, a general overview of meditation. Have you yourself engaged in meditation practices before in any way?
Yes.
What have you done? What have you been exposed to?
Transcendental meditation.
TM.
Yes, TM. Yeah. I've read the Osho's 70... I've tried some of Osho's myself, some of Osho's meditations, but...
Yes.
For me, I found that at different periods of life, I was... Some meditations were good, but some else were not for me.
Yeah.
It depends on the period, I don't know even on what it depends. I even don't know if it is good to practice one meditation when I want to and the other one when